1 year ago, one of the deadliest tornadoes in U.S. history struck Joplin, Missouri. The catastrophic EF5 multiple vortex tornado killed 160 people. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll hear conversations I had with survivors on a recent trip to Joplin. When Martha Goldman and her husband emerged from their closet after the tornado, it was the only part of their house left standing.
Honestly, I was just so grateful to be alive.
Later in the hour, we'll hear from Iowa State University researchers who surveyed the aftermath of the disaster. They'll tell us what they learned about how best to survive a tornado. That's all coming up this hour, 1 year after the Joplin disaster. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It was late afternoon on Sunday, May 22, 2011, when one of the deadliest tornadoes in U.S. history struck Joplin, Missouri. The catastrophic EF5 multiple vortex tornado killed 160 people. Audio from the moment the tornado struck was captured at a convenience store in Joplin and posted on YouTube.
The sirens aren't going.
But yeah, they did.
What?
Yeah, they did. That's as if we were coming here.
This is getting real.
The voices you hear are from a group of people who were inside the store when the tornado hit.
Everybody get down, low on the ground.
They huddled nervously in the back of the store. Then suddenly, the windows exploded. They ran into a walk-in storage fridge, nearly piling on one another.
We're good.
It's okay.
I think we're gonna do it.
Truly a nightmare. But amazingly, the people you hear in this Joplin convenience store survived one of the deadliest tornadoes in U.S. history.
Is everyone okay below me?
Right here, I'm okay.
All right, I'm trying not to lay on someone.
And somebody's on my back.
Nearly a year after that day, I visited Joplin to talk with survivors and survey the disaster area.
I'm standing next to Rangeline Road. This is the main commercial strip in the eastern part of Joplin, and this is where the tornado was at its maximum intensity. The winds were estimated to be over 200 miles per hour, with peaks up to 250 miles per hour. And at this point, the twister was nearly a mile wide. Scores of businesses, including a Walmart and a Home Depot, were flattened. Some 7,000 houses were destroyed. Let's meet some survivors.
Now, we're at Dude's Daylight Donuts at its new location on Main Street in Joplin. The original Dude's Donut Shop, established in the 1950s, was flattened by the tornado. It was a favorite hangout of Martha Goldman and Ian Coday, who meet me here today, 10 months after the disaster. The house the couple used to live in, also destroyed by the twister, was just a short walk from here. Martha recounts their harrowing story of survival, beginning that Sunday afternoon, just before the storm hit.
Well, I was out on our little sun porch where we would often eat our donuts, and I had spent most of the day painting on a painting. We had had a nice little homemade brunch earlier in the day, and it started to kind of look stormy out, and I used to love storms, so I was kind of pleased by it. It was rolling clouds and thunder and a little bit of lightning. And I didn't really think much of it until the tornado siren started going off.
And Ian, she came in, and when did you first get an idea that this was something more than the average storm?
Well, the first time I really started thinking that something was up, I guess, is when she asked me to turn off my Xbox, you know, so we could check out the weather. I was a little bit, really? But I did. She was watching the weather. And I went out to the back porch to look out and see the clouds and see what was going on, and the sirens were going off. And so I noticed some hailstones coming down, and we talked about, well, we should move our cars so that they don't get hail damage. And after I had her move her car underneath the tree, and I parked my car in a garage, and I was looking out the window again, and just something crept through the back of my mind that told me that I'm going to remember this. It was odd. I don't know how to explain it. It's just I was looking out. The neighbor had let his dog out, and it was running around, erratic. And I was like, I'm going to remember this. I didn't know why. It just told me, I'm going to remember this. And I thought it was strange that it came in my head, and I also thought it was ominous. And then probably not 2 minutes later, if that, Martha started yelling. It said that the weather we were watching on the television was saying that there was a tornado on the ground.
What did you do then, Martha?
I went and looked at the closet because we had had this plan. We were like, we'll go to the closet. It's the centermost part of the house, you know.
And you have no basement in this house. You had no basement.
No basement, just like a little one-foot crawl space and dirt floor underneath that. So, and then I started grabbing pillows and blankets and just anything that, you know, I could cover us up in. I had this just a terrible feeling. So
at one point, did you decide, we are going in the closet, we're closing the door, Ian?
Well, about this time, our ears started popping. The only thing I could compare it to is when you're driving down the highway in a car and the rear windows are rolled down just maybe a half an inch and it starts pop, 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 pop. But multiply that times 100, and it's just popping our eardrums. And I told Martha to get in the expletive closet now. And so we get in there and wrap some blankets over our heads. And it's not even a door on the closet. It's a sliding door. And I roll that shut. And right after that, start hearing chunks of things hit the house. And it starts to rattle. I mean, we got in there just in time, I would say.
I was really terrified the whole time, but I really got scared because I noticed that the wood lath on our wall started to kind of just break in. And so I could just tell, like, we had really thick plaster walls, two layers of wood lath. It was probably built in, like, 1930s. It was a solid constructed house, and I just had this sense that it was like the walls were just getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and they were being just sheared away by stuff, sandblasting it. And then, you know, the wood lath started to crack right by where we were sitting. And then I guess I didn't realize it, but the wall behind Ian's shelves went. And that was when we just had all this, like, basically like dirt and, I don't know, glass and whatever come swirling inside, and it was just kind of sandblasting our faces. And I just was waiting to die at that point. I just thought, you know, we were going to get sucked out, or something was going to come through our house. Like, I kept on thinking, like, my car might, you know, come through the house or something, or some other thing might land on us and squash us.
So Ian talked about the sounds. What do you remember about the sounds?
I don't know. Like, people say, like, it sounded like the strongest wind gust ever or a train, and I don't recall any of that. I just remember the sounds of debris hitting the walls, and it sounds a lot like tennis shoes in a dryer, as I found out a couple days later while trying to wash our tennis shoes, and I had to turn off that dryer real quick.
Because it brought back that memory.
Yeah, it definitely did. I think we were definitely suffering from some post-traumatic stress there, and certain sounds would just bring it right back.
I had this sense that I was saying to myself, this isn't real, and then realizing it was real at the same time. I was in a state of disbelief. I always kind of wanted to see one.
Did you see any of this?
I was too close to see it. Couldn't see the forest for the trees.
You were in it.
Yeah. So when the wall next to me went away, I noticed that things kind of got a little brighter, even though it was dark, because we were in the middle of a swirl of debris. But when that wall went away, that's kind of when I thought that we're done. And I squeezed on Martha and hoped to get a response back from her, you know, another squeeze. But she didn't. And that's when I got real worried that something had come through the wall and taken her out. Because I know I was leaning up against an exhaust pipe to help the crawl space breathe. And I remember when it started coming through, the exhaust pipes just started shaking and ripping back and forth. And it was unbelievable. I just couldn't believe how much force was being put into that pipe. I got to feel that force, that movement on my back as it was moving. And I just knew from what I saw when the wall went away that I was afraid that something had happened to Martha.
We were seeing with our legs crossed, just kind of, you know, facing each other and holding each other's hand and doing our best to hold pillows over our heads and whatnot.
It was just enough space for us in that closet just to kind of sit on our butts and have our knees up and just kind of hold each other.
What do you remember about the conversation at that most critical moment?
I mean, you couldn't really hear each other, but I mean, as soon as we got in there, I mean, we just kept on saying that we loved each other and kept on repeating that. You know, you want those to be your last words, so.
And on that note, Martha, Ian, and I leave the donut shop and go out into the bright sunlight to survey what's left of their old neighborhood and to find where their house used to stand. Most of the old buildings along this part of Main Street are simply gone. Martha and Ian struggle to remember where the businesses used to be.
I mean, was this maybe like the music shop right here? And there's the clock shop and... I don't even know.
I know this parking lot up here belonged to the Mexican restaurant, El Vaquero.
This was a friend's house, a girl named Whitney.
This is just a barren lot now, just grass and some... a little bit of debris here. That was a friend's house.
Yeah. Her family owned a beautiful kind of yellow brick house, and I don't know, just gone. She was in her car, actually, parked right out here, and somehow survived. You know, her back was pretty beaten up, but she made it.
When you got out of your house... how you had taken so much care with your cars. What kind of shape were they in, Ian?
Well, the car which I had parked in the garage ended up flipped upside down on top of my neighbor's house.
Your car landed on your neighbor's house?
Yes.
And your car had been in the garage?
My car was in the garage, which I parked there because I was afraid it was going to get hail damage. But it got more than that. Martha's car was, I told her to park it underneath a tree to avoid getting any hail damage, hoping the leaves would help slow the hail down. And the tree fell on top of her car, thankfully, I think, because otherwise it might have ended up upside down on our house.
I mean, two nights before, I was talking to a good friend who was moving to Portland, and her husband, they got rid of pretty much everything they owned, and I was like, oh, Lauren, it must be so nice to not have all that stuff. I wish I didn't have all this stuff. I feel weighed down by it. And then it's all taken away, and I honestly, I was just so grateful to be alive that the stuff just really didn't matter anymore.
So we've been walking through your neighborhood from Dude's Daylight Donuts and walking across through still some rubble, half-broken sidewalks, past construction equipment here, various things. And we have stopped on an area of the sidewalk. I'm thinking we've stopped at the site of your former house. Is this it?
Yep, this is it. This was our driveway, and you can kind of see the outline of where our house used to be. Our daffodils that separated our house from our neighbors are kind of coming up.
Well, let's go up there. What can you approximate where that closet was, and let's walk up there. So are we in the closet here, or where are we at?
No, closet would be probably about here.
So while we say this is your former house, what do we actually see?
Gravel. Gravel, chunks of concrete. It's nice to see like a little bit of nature coming through. So there's some pretty little wildflowers, or probably what people consider weeds, coming up.
Martha, you picked up a shard of glass. What is that? Do you know?
This was one of my 1950s turquoise glasses that I had. Well, tumbler glass.
You found that just now?
Yeah. Pretty much every time I come back here, I find something else that I recognize that was ours. I mean, months afterwards, I would come back here and just kind of sift through stuff. Even after they had bulldozed things away, you can still find little remnants here and there of your former life.
Wow. You gonna keep that?
Yeah. I have a whole bag of broken shards that I plan on making into an art piece, so this will probably go in.
You're an artist, so has this experience been reflected in your art?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I just finished a painting of a kind of pinup style girl sucked up inside of a tornado, and our house is in it, and it's kind of anamorphized, and it's being ripped apart, and the girl's being speared by a branch off of our trees that we used to have, and because I really kind of thought that's what was going to happen to me. So
a lot of people who survive great catastrophes, whether it be a natural catastrophe or a man-made one, the survivors ask, why did I come through this? Does that cross your mind?
I know that it was pretty amazing, considering that all the houses around us were decimated, and of all the houses, the only thing left was our closet that we were in, and that was the only thing left standing.
What made that so strong, that structure?
If I were to try to put logic behind it, there was an old chimney that was maybe a foot and a half by foot and a half that gave some extra support. But, I mean, metal telephone poles were sliced like they were butter in half. And power stations were just leveled. I don't see how an old brick chimney could really help support much. It just seems, I don't like to use the word lightly, but it seemed like we were blessed. And
you consider yourself a religious person?
Not religious. I would say I'm spiritual. I give credence to the great unknown, and that which lies beyond ourselves. And I think it's important for everybody to know that without the mystery of life, it seems shallow to me.
That for me is a scary thing to think about. I would consider myself spiritual, but I'm also very scientific with some of my beliefs, and so I didn't feel comfortable at first when people said that I was blessed and that God was watching over us. But the more and more that I heard that, the more and more comforted. I felt by that. I personally, when we were in that closet, I tried to envision this protective, invisible bubble over us. And, you know, I'm not saying that it was the power of my mind that saved us or anything, but I just felt like we had so much left to do. And I really wanted to pursue things that I loved. So I feel like we were given that chance.
So we're back. You come out of the closet. What are the first things you see? What are the first things you hear?
Well, the first things I hear before I get out of the closet, which really, really disturbed me, was the first thing I knew that the tornado was gone was when I heard a girl screaming, and I looked out through my closet shelves, and I saw this girl running through the parking lot of the Salvation Army next door.
Right down the...
But after I left the closet, the first thing I really looked at and latched onto was, and I told Martha, "Well, this whole time we had beautiful hardwood floors."
We loathed the we just don't like carpet, and we have these carpeted floors that we rented, so we couldn't do anything about it. And there's just these beautiful floors underneath that, you know, were exposed because the tornado basically ripped off our carpeting. So,
and so you had not known these beautiful floors were there.
No, we always wanted to get rid of the carpet, but of course we were renters, and so.
And so you're standing there, probably still in shock, and you notice.
Yeah, I was probably definitely in shock, and I was walking around barefoot. I didn't have anything on but a pair of shorts, and I wasn't. I don't know. I don't think I paid attention to a whole lot except for the floors at first.
You know, especially speaking with an artist, artistic people, we could take that as sort of a symbol, couldn't we?
The floors?
Yes, the carpeting you never liked and the destruction revealing something beautiful you never knew was there.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
It's a beautiful idea. Yeah, I think it's very true in many ways. You don't realize what you have until you don't. You don't realize the friends you have until you're in a time of need and they show up and willing and ready to help.
Well, I want to thank you very much for your time and for taking us on this walk to the site of your former home. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks. I'm glad to have you along.
And thank you, Martha.
Thank you so much.
Martha Goldman and Ian Coday, survivors of one of the deadliest tornadoes in U.S. history, in Joplin, Missouri, May 22nd, 2011. You can see pictures of Ian and Martha holding that shard of glass and Martha's Twister-inspired painting at iowapublicradio.org or Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Coming up, another survivor story. 76-year-old Carolyn Pendergraf talks about surviving her basement while above, her half-century-old donut shop was ripped apart by 200-mile-per-hour winds. Then a conversation with Iowa State University researchers who visited the aftermath of this disaster. They'll tell us what their survey of the structural damage in Joplin reveals about how best to survive a tornado. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A track hoe clears debris from a neighborhood in Joplin, Missouri, or what used to be a neighborhood, I should say. Joplin is still cleaning up and rebuilding after one of the deadliest tornadoes in U.S. history struck the city on Sunday, May 22, 2011. On that day, 160 people lost their lives when the nearly mile-wide EF5 tornado devastated miles of neighborhoods and businesses. 7,000 homes were destroyed in a few minutes. Later in the program, we'll hear from researchers at Iowa State University. They surveyed the aftermath of this disaster to learn what happens to structures facing over 200-mile-an-hour winds. But first, back to my recent visit to Joplin to talk with survivors.
I'm on Main Street now in Joplin, and really, besides the new houses that have sprung up, In the meantime, there's a few barren trees, mostly broken off. Otherwise, the landscape is barren except for the telephone poles that have been put up. And I'm outside the newly reopened Dude's Daylight Donuts on Main Street. It's a family-owned business dating back to the 1950s. The old location of Dude's is just across the street. All that is left of that is a stone slab foundation. Let's go into the new Dude's Donuts and talk to Carolyn Pendergraft. She and her husband, the original Dude, own the business. They have since they started it up in the 1950s. When the tornado swept through, they were in their house just about a block away from here. Let's go in.
They tell us it was 3/4 of a mile wide, and it moved like 20 miles an hour. But inside the tornado, they said it was over 300 miles an hour.
And so you were down in the basement. I understand it took maybe a minute or two to pass over. What do you remember about the most intense part of the storm above you?
Just hearing it rip the roof off. It was not like the sound of a train. I didn't hear that. Others said they did, but I did not. It was just a huge roar, and I could literally hear the ripping of the roof, and that was it.
You were in fear for your life?
No, I was not. We were in the basement. I was against a cement wall. I mean, really, I did not. I felt like we were safe. Some of the houses, our little house south and north of us, just a small house, and they were gone. But when I looked out my window, I did have a window standing. There's some windows standing. There's just various destruction to the house in various places. It's strange. And there's a little table sitting there with two chairs, like it had never been touched, and the rest of the house had been destroyed. Like I said, other houses were completely demolished. Others were just barely touched. Some were in their closets, and that's the part of the house that survived was the closet. Others were in the bathtub, and some of them remained in the house, and others were thrown out into the yard. We've had all kinds of stories. And
what's the most amazing story you've heard about this?
Several saw their children were rising up from under them, and they grabbed them by the ankle and pulled them back down.
Pulled up in the air.
Yeah, the suction was so tremendous. This man was in his bathroom and had two children, his wife, and he was hovered over them. And he felt, I believe it was a little 9-year-old boy being pulled out from under him. And he was rising up. And he reached up and grabbed the little boy by the ankle and pulled him back down. And when the storm passed, they were out in the yard in the bathtub. They had literally taken them all out. They asked the little boy, he said, well, how did that feel? He said, well, for a minute I thought I was Superman because, you know, how children think. Other children were just frightened and still are when they hear the storm. There's just so many stories.
A recent conversation with longtime Joplin resident Carolyn Pendergraft. Together with her husband, the original Dude, Carolyn runs Dude's Daylight Donuts, now at its new location on Main Street. This is River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Three Iowa State University researchers visited the immediate aftermath of the Joplin tornado to survey the structural damage and to find out what it revealed about how best to survive a tornado. I recently spoke with two of those researchers. Bill Gallus is a professor in ISU's Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences. Chris Karstens is a graduate research assistant in that department. Before I asked them about their survey findings, I began by asking them what stood out about the survivors' accounts.
I think I was impressed by what people did, Ian and Martha, going into the closet. It's always nice when you hear people doing what they've been told to do. But also the woman who owned the donut store going into the basement and feeling perfectly safe. And I guess from what we saw in Joplin, that actually bothers me a little bit. I think it would be nice to have that peace. But after what we saw in Joplin, I don't think I would have had that peace even if I was in a basement.
So underground with a tornado of this force, you cannot be assured of surviving anything no matter where you are.
Right. In the basement, the biggest problem is the debris that can be thrown into the basement. And I think I remember hearing Ian talk about the fear that the car would have been tossed onto them. So generally, if you go to a basement, now the advice is usually to get under something like a workbench or a table. And you can imagine if a car was tossed onto a small table that you're under in the basement, it's still questionable whether you would come out of that without any injuries.
Mm-hmm. Bill, what else did you find interesting in their accounts?
I find it always amazing what winds of that strength in a very strong tornado can actually do. And we heard the discussion of people pretty much levitating, the winds blowing so strong, perhaps the suction effect or the very strong upward motion in a tornado, being able to just lift you upward. I know we'll probably mention this a little bit later, but in our survey, it was amazing to see that parking stops that were held to the ground by metal rebar were actually blown away. I think it's almost impossible for the average person to fathom what winds of 200 miles per hour can do.
These parking stops are, 300-400 pounds?
Right. Some of the standard ones are 6 feet long, some are 8 feet long, and they can be over 300 pounds, and yet they blew, in some cases, 20 or 30 feet or more away.
Chris Karstens, you're a graduate research assistant working with Bill Gallus. What did you hear in the accounts of the survivors that you found most interesting from your perspective?
Yeah, one thing that really stood out to me was the gentleman who said that, he looked outside, looked at, any sort of visual indications that would kind of clue him in as to what was coming. One thing he really didn't mention was the actual visual indication of a tornado. And I think that this was pretty common with this event, that the tornado either was so wide that it was indistinguishable, or in sort of the later half of the tornado's life, it became wrapped in rain. So from that perspective, it pretty much negates the whole purpose of even trying to go see what was coming. Another thing that kind of stood out, and related to that was that they had multiple sources of information that they were trying to sort through and trying to kind of decide what kind of thing to do next. And I think that that's pretty common, it's human nature really to do that. And so, it seems as though they had enough of those indicators then to really act on, what was coming and then take the proper course of action for them, which, in the absence of a storm shelter or a basement, they chose the best location, which was the center location of the house in a closet.
As people who work in geological and atmospheric sciences, how do you explain the uneven quality of the damage? Here in the accounts we heard in Martha and Ian's neighborhood, all the houses were leveled, the only thing left standing being a closet that they were in, or a table and chair are left seemingly untouched while everything else is flattened. How do you explain that scientifically?
The problem we face as scientists is that might be due to variations in the wind in the tornado. When you get very large tornadoes, they can break down into these multiple vortices, like many swirling tornadoes all rotating around a common point. So it might have been that they, in effect, got lucky and they didn't really experience as strong a winds as their neighbors. But we've also seen in a lot of these surveys, it's amazing how much construction practices differ. We noticed in several neighborhoods in Joplin that sometimes the only wall you would see standing would be a wall where the people had stone on the exterior. And it was brought to our attention that when the homes were built nearly 100 years ago, stone was often the cheapest material. So these might have been the homes of the people that had the least money. But it appeared the stone actually held up to the forces of the tornado better than almost anything else. And so you might find a little piece of a house remaining that had stone on the exterior.
Tell us about your survey. You started conducting your damage survey 4 days after the tornado struck, May 26th. You were there for a couple days. What did you set out to do?
Well, the primary goal was to look at engineered structures. And by that, we're talking about structures like Home Depot, Walmart, the hospital, the high school, structures that are sort of built to some sort of standard practice. And from those structures, those sort of offer the best means of estimating winds from the tornado. So we set out to really look and target those specific areas in Joplin.
What were your most interesting findings?
I think Bill sort of keyed in on one of those things, which was those parking stops that really struck us as being something very unique. Not only the weight, but also the very low profile. Because it's so low to the ground, That means that winds right near the ground had to be very, very strong to do that. So that was one thing. It was pretty interesting. You know, another aspect that was also interesting was the time that we spent at the high school and trying to decide what was maybe the best or most ideal locations for students to be located in the high school to have the best chance of surviving. You know, the auditorium at the school, the bricks had come down into the center part of the auditorium, and they were lucky in that you know, the commencement ceremony was scheduled for that day, but because of the large number of people that were expected to attend, they actually moved it to a different part of town, to a community college, and therefore the ceremony did not occur at the high school. So that was sort of a fortunate situation there because, you know, as I mentioned there, that the bricks and walls and other mm-hmm. material come down in there. So,
I noticed in your report, too, you had even lower profile, heavier things. We had manhole covers being sucked out of streets. How does that happen? Mm-hmm.
Right. That was I remember I think the first one in our group to notice the missing manhole cover and began looking around in piles of debris that were scattered around thinking I'd find it. And we never did find where it went. Surprisingly, when we did the tests, though, on the manhole covers, I believe we found that they were right near the center line of the tornado where you would expect to have the biggest drop in the air pressure. And it was turned out the winds wouldn't have to be as strong to remove the manhole covers because the pressure, the suction effect, would have been so powerful in the middle of the tornado that it would have helped to pop them out of the ground.
Hmm. You talked about this tornado having multiple vortexes. It was one of the largest tornadoes that we've seen in many decades as far as wind speeds. How do you determine the speed of the wind in a tornado based on the damage that you survey?
That is probably one of the toughest things to do. There's a lot of controversy about this, and we really wish we had instruments that could tell us what the winds were doing in a tornado. For instance, in Joplin, I know Tim Marshall, who has probably surveyed more tornadoes than anyone else on the planet, and he's been giving several talks recently pointing out that so much of the massive destruction that you saw in Joplin could have actually been caused by winds that were only equal to an EF3 tornado because it turns out the construction practices things weren't built as good as we would like to think they were. So there's a lot of error associated with using the damage to try to figure out what the winds are.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, when we have looked at several of these unusual clues to wind speeds, like the parking stops, where we were able to do some tests in the laboratory, you know, that seems to support the idea that the winds really were over 200 miles per hour. But when you look at even some of these large structures, for instance, the Home Depot, it turns out the way those buildings are made, it really doesn't take winds anywhere close to 200 miles per hour to destroy a place like that.
Right. They have a large flat surface that acts almost like a sail, and they just pancake together. Isn't that what happened?
Yes.
Right. Yep.
And even in the even near the high school, they had a technical school across the street, and it was fascinating to see that place was almost totally destroyed, and there'd be areas where you'd only see maybe 3 feet of the wall remaining up from the ground, other areas where you might see 5 or 6 feet, and you could look, and it seemed to be directly a function of how far up the metal rebar extended from the ground. If it only went up 3 feet, that's all that remained. If it went up about 6 feet, then you had, you know, a little bit more of the wall that did remain standing.
Now, let's talk a little bit about how your findings can help us survive tornadoes. You said specifically Joplin High School, that was one of your goals there. What can you tell us, based on what you surveyed and your knowledge of these things, how can you best survive a tornado? I'm assuming we don't want to be in a large structure with a large open area like a Home Depot, like a gymnasium in a high school.
Right. One of the more disturbing things I remember hearing in some media accounts right after the Joplin tornado happened were the large number of people that said they were out on the roads or they left their house to drive to places like Walmart or Home Depot. And I think there may be a danger that some people picture the bigger the building, the better if a tornado's coming. And I think we know that you don't want to be in a place that has a wide open roof like a gym mm-hmm. or a large box retailer. You want to be definitely underground if you can get there.
And I think in the meantime, the Home Depot has been rebuilt, and they have a storm shelter there, which is causing other concerns because people know there is a storm shelter there. And then once a tornado is on the way again, there may be a traffic jam to get to the Home Depot's storm shelter.
Right. Yeah, that presents absolutely another problem in and of itself. And I know other places around the country have you know, encountered that similar sort of effect.
Right. One of the most famous big tornado events in the 1970s was a tornado that hit Wichita Falls, Texas. And in that event, the majority of the people who died were in their cars. So I know meteorologists are very hesitant to recommend community shelters because there's this fear. We know in the past that if you're caught out on the road in a tornado, you know, your chance of survival really gets pretty low.
Can you say anything specifically about schools since you looked at Joplin High School, which was completely destroyed, turned into a pile of rubble, about how we can make schools of any size safer?
One of the things I think all of us were noticing in Joplin is that many schools are built with long hallways that tend to have doors with glass windows at each end. And in Joplin, that appeared to be the case, and they became wind tunnels with debris flying through them. And it appeared in some cases that the safer place for kids would have actually been in some of the interior rooms. Mm-hmm. The Joplin School was built, part of it at least, had the shape of a U. And it looked like if you were in some of those classrooms on the inside of the U, even though the wall to the courtyard oftentimes fell down, it appeared there wasn't a lot of debris or a lot of wind in those rooms, and you would have been safer than in the hallway. So I think as new schools are built, they really need to rethink this idea of where they're putting glass windows in relation to the orientation of the hallways.
I noticed nearly a year after this devastating tornado in Joplin that the city is now full of contractors, has been for many months, installing safe rooms in homes. Many of the homes, I believe only 25% of the homes in Joplin, have basements. Can you tell us anything about those? These are stone-structured closets inside houses, I think.
Absolutely. There's all sorts of different kinds of storm safety rooms that can be installed. Some are above ground, reinforced metal. Also, you can do it with just CMU block with rebar throughout. Also, you can put them below ground, ones that go either in your garage or your backyard. So there's a variety of different options out there. And this is if you really are serious about this and really want to take really good action to try to make this, a non-issue for you in the future, it's probably the way to go. Some of the work we're doing here at Iowa State is trying to shed light on how we can design structures a little bit better to withstand, at least low-end tornado strength winds. And so measures like putting hurricane straps on the upper wall connections between the upper wall and the rafter, and also like J bolts in the concrete footings. That those things can help for low end tornadoes, but when you're talking winds like in Joplin near the center line, upwards of 200 miles per hour, complete destruction is almost certain. And so the safe room probably the way to go if you're really, really serious about protecting yourself.
In closing, what can you tell us about the best, quickest, perhaps hopefully lowest cost ways to improve survival, to improve structures so that we survive? Is it more our behavior during storms or our building of structures that will help us out?
that's a tough question. You can certainly try to come up with ways of building your structure a little bit more soundly, and implementing some more rigid construction practices, and then really going over the top then and installing the safe room, and then of course all of that is with no purpose without actually listening to the warning and acting on that, and then basically trying to take all precautionary measures to save your life.
Right. There's been a lot of social science research that's been done since Joplin trying to understand why so many people died. And as the people that you interviewed often pointed out, it's not enough for most people to hear the siren or the tornado warning. They need some other clue, some other verification. and I think maybe one lesson I hope everyone learned from Joplin is what Chris alluded to earlier. When you have a tornado that wide and you have the rain wrapped around it, you may not get a very good visual clue. And we may have to try to get people to react more quickly as soon as they hear a warning or as soon as they hear a siren.
Bill Gallus, professor in the Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at Iowa State University, along with Chris Carstens, a graduate research assistant in that same department. Bill and Chris, thank you very much for your time and your fascinating insights.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Bill Gallus is a professor in Iowa State University's Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences. Chris Carstens is a graduate research assistant in that department. They surveyed the immediate aftermath of the tornado that struck Joplin, Missouri, May 22, 2011. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer, production assistants by Allison Sullivan, and my production assistant in Joplin was Liam Kiefer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.